are listening to WNHN LP 94.7 in Concord. This is Statehouse Watch. I'm Arnie Alpert.
And I'm Maggie Fogarty. We're here from the American Friends Service Committee with our weekly radio broadcast, adapted for these COVID-19 times. Our weekly newsletter, Statehouse Watch, continues to go out on Friday afternoons in the early evening to keep you abreast of the activity both from the Office of the Governor as well as we saw this past week, steps that the legislature is taking to help New Hampshire respond to this crisis.
You can find out about Statehouse Watch and more about our work at the American Friends Service Committee from our website at afsc.org/NH, where you can hit the subscribe button to join the Statehouse Watch newsletter, and you can find out more about this radio station and its 24-hour broadcasting and lots of podcasts, including ones of this show, which you can find at WNHNFM.org, where you can also look for and hit that Donate Now button to keep community radio going in these difficult times. It's a great way for us to be connected even when we are physically apart. So Maggie, this past week we had a couple of interesting developments on the issue of voting rights, which we will talk more about later in the show. But do you want to mention a couple of the points that were made?
We were delighted to see this week that a New Hampshire Superior Court judge has struck down SB 3 that would have put onerous requirements, pages and pages worth of explanation of requirements for voter registration that would take place in the 30 days prior to an election.
Well, we'll talk a little bit later in the show with Louise Spencer of the Kent Street Coalition about that. And then we also had a memorandum, a guidance memo promoted by the Secretary of State and the Attorney General that came out on Friday afternoon. And it says, in effect, that because of the pandemic and the restrictions on social gatherings, we can all consider ourselves to be disabled for the purposes of voting by absentee ballot. So we'll discuss that with Deborah Pignatelli from the Executive Council and also with Louise Spencer and Kiri Claflin from the Kent Street Coalition a little bit later in the show.
You know, and let's hope, Arnie, for the sake of ensuring access to the vote, a fundamental tenet of our democracy, that adaptations in this crisis will point the way to a broader, more lasting policy of increasing access to the ballot, including no excuse absentee voting. So I know people have been pushing these issues for some time. The obviousness of their benefits are made clear in this moment, and hopefully we can see them as good policy in an ongoing way and work to make that happen.
One of the other areas where adaptation is obviously needed has to do with how the state is going to adapt its budget in order to accommodate the $1.2 billion or perhaps more that is supposed to come our way from the Federal CARES Act. The governor says it's up to him under his state of emergency. The legislators say it's up to them under their legislative powers.
That's right. So they had the fiscal committee had their first kind of Zoom landy. I don't know if it was Zoom or not that they used, but their first virtual public meeting last Friday.
Well, they did agree to accept some federal funding, but a $1.2 million, not $1 billion. But actually, just this morning, Maggie, the leaders of the House and Senate have gone to court to ask the court to intervene to uphold their authority to be the ones who officially accept the federal funds, which they state is what the law provides for. So we'll be joined very shortly in an interview with Representative Mary Jane Wallner, who chairs the Joint Fiscal Committee. But it's interesting, you noted, Maggie, that the Fiscal Committee met by teleconference. It's the first time ever that a New Hampshire Legislative Committee has found a way to do that, to meet remotely, and still to comply with the requirements of our right to know laws, which do say that the legislators need to meet in person when people can listen in to what they're doing. So whether that creates a precedent that can now be expanded in some ways to let the rest of the legislature back into session is something that remains to be seen, but we'll continue to keep you apprised of that here on Statehouse.
And again, I mean, we're living in times that are extraordinary and we are adapting. Some teacher friends in my neighborhood wonder aloud if there will ever be another snow day because classrooms have adapted imperfectly, perhaps in many instances, but they have learned how to adapt to to this challenge of social distancing. So we may well be living into some new behaviors that affect our legislature, our classroom, our access to the ballot.
Well, it's interesting. There's been already discussion this year about how to make legislative hearings more accessible, for example, to people who live in the North Country. If you've got a 3-hour drive to get to Concord for a public hearing, you're a lot less likely to do that. For me, I live in Canterbury. My office is 2 blocks from the legislative office building. It's easy for me to get over there, and that makes it more possible for me to participate in our democracy than people who live far away. So that's something that can be remedied by increased use of technology. We can hope that we're learning some lessons about this, about the types of services and opportunities that ought to be available equally to everybody, but certainly are affected by issues of geography, as well as issues that have to do with class, issues that have to do with race, issues that have to do with disability in normal times. And maybe the new normal will be better than the old normal once it gets going again. Now, Maggie, you've been closely following issues of people who are in detention, especially at the Stratford County Jail in Dover. What can you say in terms of an update for our listeners for this week?
Well, this past weekend on Saturday, Never Again Action New Hampshire organized a car rally. Cars drove past the jail windows so that those imprisoned inside could see expressions of support for their release. Messages also included support for staff who are exposed to coronavirus by the ways that Immigration and Customs Enforcement handles and transfers people in detention. So there's definitely a chorus of support growing for the release of civilly detained people in ICE custody. And so we want to continue to put pressure not only on the county officials who are a part of that contract with ICE, but also on Governor Sununu's mind so that as he manages the state's emergency response, he is remaining mindful of the acute vulnerability of imprisoned people. And then, of course, we need to be sending a message to our members of Congress and to ICE that this kind of exposure to potentially fatal illness is inhumane and can be stopped and should be stopped immediately.
And it's absolutely unnecessary. Maggie, I understand that a message to ICE was sent by a federal judge in Massachusetts last week.
Yes, that was very exciting. Judge Young in the U.S. District Court in Massachusetts did approve a class of applicants for release from ICE detention, and on a daily basis is approving the release after a review of public safety considerations of 10 ICE detainees each day. So has been good news to watch that unfold, and perhaps it would be replicable here in New Hampshire. We shall see.
Well, it is indeed a mixed up world that we are in, so that will be the theme of a song we're about to hear, and when we come back, we'll have our recent interview with Representative Mary Jane Wallner. You are listening to State House Watch.
By the children of the ever most high. Oh, what a mix up world we're living in. Yeah, it's a mix up world we're living in. Yeah, now some rise to power by spilling blood of a brother for them to be great and cup their people with hunger. Joining arms race, everyone wanna be world leader. Joining arms race, they all want to rule this world. Look, this year. Mix up, world we're living in. Yeah, this year. Mix up, world we're living in. Mix up, world we're living in, yeah, it's a mix up, world.
join in arms race. Everyone wanna be world leader. Join in arms race. They all want to rule this world. Look this up. Mix up, mix up. World we're living in, yeah, it's a mix up, mix up. World we're living in.
We've just heard about an emergency lawsuit filed by the leaders of the New Hampshire House and Senate stating that it's really up to the Joint Fiscal Committee, not the governor, to make the final approval on spending emergency funds from the federal government. We are joined right now on State House Watch by Representative Mary Jane Wallner, who chairs the House-Senate Joint Fiscal Committee. Mary Jane, welcome back to State House Watch.
Hi, Arnie. Nice to see you.
Representative Wallner, can you explain to us what just happened with this court filing today?
Well, for the last several weeks, we've been working with the governor's office. We've been talking with the governor's office. I've sent a couple of letters about how when the $1.25 billion comes to the state, how that will actually be spent. And the governor, I think you saw that he has a special office that he wants to set up that will administer that money. The process in state government is always that money being spent or being accepted by the state comes through the fiscal committee. And the fiscal committee is made up of 5 House members and 5 Senate members. Items come to us from departments about how they are going to accept and expend finances. And it could be anything from federal money to special grants to the state. And they all come through the fiscal committee. And our authority is RSA 14:30A. And what it says, and I'll just read this one part of it. Any non-state funds in excess of $100,000, whether public or private, including refunds, expenditures, federal aid, local funds, may be accepted and expended by the proper persons or agencies in the state government only with the prior approval of the fiscal committee of the general court. So all money that is accepted and expended by the state, no matter where it comes from, flows through the general court, through the fiscal committee, when the general court when our budget is already in place. So these are monies that come in after the budget has been put into place. So then there's another section, RSA 9:13-D, and it says, should it be determined by the governor that a civil emergency exists, the governor may, with the advice and consent of the fiscal committee, authorize such expenditures by any department or agency as may be necessary to effectively deal with said civil emergency. So I think that makes it pretty clear. Those two statutes make it pretty clear that the fiscal committee, acting on behalf of the legislature, does accept and expend funding even in an emergency.
So but the governor was asked about this last week, and he basically said that law is superseded by another state law granting him his emergency powers.
Right. And I think that's exactly what we're going to court to ask that question.
So where is it then in court? It just was filed this morning.
No, it's just filed this morning.
Does that go to the state Supreme Court?
No, I believe it went to Superior Court in Hillsborough Superior Court.
Okay. And
what's your expectation of timing?
Well, we're hoping that the timing will be very, very quick, because the anticipation is that these federal funds will be available to the state probably next week. So we really hope that this can be worked out and settled by the time that the funding is available. This was not our first choice. We've been trying to work with the governor's office around this for a few weeks. He has said that, you know, this is just another step. The fiscal committee can't work rapidly. That is really not correct. We can be called back at the call of the chair. I can call the fiscal committee in every day if that's what's needed. Mm-hmm. To act on items that the governor might bring before us. So, mm-hmm. And I have expressed that in letters, and I last week at the fiscal committee, I expressed that we were more than willing to meet as often as is necessary to be sure that this money is spent appropriately for the state of New Hampshire.
Well, as you say, it's unfortunate that it has to come to a court case, but it does seem like a very important principle to defend yes. So that our government can continue to function as it was intended, even during right. emergency times.
Yeah. I think the fiscal committee is something that not all of the public, but a lot of the public really understand and know what the fiscal committee does. We have a monthly meeting. That's true. We do have a monthly meeting. We have agendas. Our agenda items are posted. We have a lot of public input. People are always contacting us about certain items that are on the fiscal committee agenda. And I think it's a process that really is important so that the public and the legislature can have a role in making some of these decisions.
Well, finally, Representative Wallner, last week the fiscal committee met for the first time by teleconference. In fact, I think
yes.
it was the first time ever for a legislative committee to meet that way. How did it go? And do you anticipate that the legislature will start to be able to make use of technology to get back in session anytime soon?
Yeah. Well, we did have a meeting on Friday. The fiscal committee is the first time we've ever met remotely. And it went very well, I thought. It went very smoothly. The technology seemed to work. All the members were there and participated. Unlike what was said in the by the governor's office that we weren't able to respond quickly. I think we did respond quickly. And actually, on that agenda, there was some federal funding for the coronavirus relief through the Meals on Wheels. And that money is going out to provide more Meals on Wheels for senior citizens in New Hampshire during this crisis. So I think we're well suited to work rapidly if we need to.
Well, that's great to hear. Representative Mary Jane Wallner, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you very much.
Representative Mary Jane Wallner chairs the Joint Fiscal Committee. She also chairs the House Finance Committee. This morning, Representative Wallner and other legislative leaders went to court to ask for clarification of who actually has the authority to approve the acceptance of $1.2 billion or more in federal funds coming to New Hampshire for pandemic relief.
You are listening to State House Watch Radio on WNHN 94.7 FM.
Deborah Pignatelli is a member of the Executive Council, representing District 5, which goes all the way from Nashua to Swansea.
Executive Councilor Deborah Pignatelli, welcome to State House Watch.
Thank you very much, Arnie. It's good to be here remotely with you.
Now, I've known you a long time through your long service at the legislature. You were a state representative, you were a state senator, you're an executive counselor now. Could you just say a word or two about how you decided to get into that type of politics and what it's been like for you over more than a couple of years?
So it was 1986, And I had a job that I really enjoyed. I was helping people who were injured on the job and collecting workers' compensation. And I was helping them to get a medical endpoint, find a job for them, and set them up given whatever disabilities they had. I got a call from the mayor's administrative assistant in Nashua saying, "We need you to put your name on the ballot on our side, on the Democratic side. Don't worry, you're not going to win. We just need to fill our side of the ticket." So I thought, well, you know, I'll help them. I'll put my name on the ballot, but I'm not going to campaign. And lo and behold, I won a seat in the House of Representatives. And so I served a term. I was on the Children, Youth, and Elderly Committee, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed my service. I enjoyed helping children and youth and elderly that first term. So I ran again. And then I ran a third term, but in the middle of the third term, we moved from one ward to another. It was just really a quarter of a mile, but I was out of the district, so I needed to resign in the middle of my third term. Mary Nelson, who was the state senator, decided sometime during that spring that she was not going to run again for the state senate, and I decided that I would run for state senate and won and served five terms there, being on various committees. Then I retired in 2000. Then in 2004, I took a look at the executive council and who was representing me and my district, and I thought, this person does not represent my views in any way, and I decided that I would try to run for the executive council, and I won.
Deborah Pignatelli, I remember you as a stalwart supporter of the Martin Luther King holiday from back when you were a state representative and then when you were a state senator. I also remember your coming to the conclusion that New Hampshire could live without the death penalty and becoming a stalwart supporter of death penalty repeal. So I want to thank you for those stands that you've taken in the past. But note that today, the concern that's on my mind and on the mind of a lot of voters has to do with elections and the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on the ability of people to register to vote and to vote. And last Wednesday, you brought those concerns or tried to bring those concerns to the Executive Council meeting in Concord.
I did.
Let's hear a little bit from last week's Executive Council meeting.
Governor.
Yes, Councilor Pignatelli.
I wonder if before we start the meat of our meeting, we might start with our Secretary of State, who has been invited to this meeting, and some of us would like to talk to him about our concerns about the election process this September and November. So I'm wondering if we might be, if you might be willing to start with him. And I know a lot of my constituents and residents around the state are dialed in to hear what he might have to tell us about his thinking.
I believe your questions revolve around some of the potential changes or guidance that would follow with the election process. Is that correct?
I have some specific questions for the Secretary of State, and I also want to hear what his thinking is and how he sees this process as we go forward with COVID-19.
A couple things. The Attorney General of the Secretary of State's office, is my understanding, is going to be releasing a guidance document out in the next couple of days that it probably addresses a lot of the questions that you may have. The questions around elections are obviously very important. They don't really come under the purview of the governor and executive council. And as we said before, if you'd like to reach out to him directly, either as a follow-up to the guidance document or even as a precursor, of course, you're always and encouraged to do so. Anybody is, frankly. He's very accessible. But I don't believe he's joining us this morning, as I think the questions that you're proposing don't pertain to the governor council agenda.
Well, they might not pertain to the agenda, but as far as I know, we are the only constitutional body meeting now. And I think it's very important for the Secretary of State in a public setting to address the citizens of this state and to answer some of the executive counselor's questions about where he is and what he is thinking. And I would like to ask my question so at least my constituents know what I am thinking, even if he has not been invited to this meeting. You know, one of our jobs as executive counselors are to be the eyes and ears of our constituents and the residents of the state. I have heard from many people about their concern about voting. I think that the Secretary of State and what he does in terms of deciding on who votes, how we vote particularly this September and November, comes under the purview of representing my constituents and representing them well.
So, Councillor Pignatelli, shortly after, 2 days after that back and forth between you and the governor, the Secretary of State and the Attorney General, in fact, did release the guidance. And I'm curious if you've had a chance to review it and have a reaction.
I have reviewed it briefly, Arnie, and I think it's a good start. I compliment the Attorney General and the Secretary of State for putting some thought into this document and for hearing what a lot of us have been saying about our ability to vote in this strange time of COVID-19.
Let me ask if I understand it correctly. By my understanding of it, the existing law and procedures for voters to apply for an absentee ballot and vote absentee includes being disabled. And the Attorney General and Secretary of State are now saying that in effect, because of COVID-19, that all of us are disabled, and therefore everybody who feels they cannot safely go to their polling place is eligible to vote absentee. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding, and it is of some concern. A lot of people will not want to check the disabled box because they're not going to be voting because they'd like to stay at home. I would prefer to see a COVID-19 box on the absentee ballot request, and so people can check that off. And I have other concerns about it as well. Basically, I think it's a good start. I think that the Secretary of State and the Attorney General deserve some credit for putting this document out. And I'm hoping that they'll be willing to listen to some of the concerns and make changes as needed.
It's not really precedented for either of those office holders to come to public forums and address the public, is it?
I don't know whether, the Attorney General has been on television and addressing the public at times and answering media's questions, and probably the Secretary of State may have at some time during the FRM scandal been on television and answering media questions, but this is a really important time for all of the citizens in the state. It looks like we could have an enormous turnout this fall for our elections. And I think we need to make it as easy as possible and as convenient as possible for voters to vote. Now, there are some voters who aren't going to want absentee ballots. They're going to want to vote at the polling place. And how will that look? I'm looking to the Attorney General and the Secretary of State to give us some indication about how that's going to work. What about the poll workers who many now are elderly? Are they going to want to possibly put themselves in danger? Are we going to hire new, younger poll workers? Are people going to be wearing masks to vote, and so they won't be able to be recognized when a poll worker looks at their driver's license? You know, these are all issues that deserve some thought and some consideration. Now, let me just say a little bit about Secretary of State Gardner. So I've known him probably longer than I've known you, and he runs good elections. He has a lot of experience in this. He knows what elections are like around the state. He knows the statistics, but this is a very unusual time now, and many secretaries of state are having to think about these issues when they've never had to think about them before. So I want to compliment him, but also ask that he and some of the others put on their thinking caps and come up with some new and novel ways so that people can vote. You know, one possible way is that a ballot be sent to every registered voter in the state. I don't know whether that would work, but it's something to think about. Also, who opens all of these absentee ballots? Do our town officials do it? And it takes days for them to get through this number of ballots. Does the state do it? Do we hire 50 people? What happens if the ballot isn't postmarked by the date it needs to be postmarked? What happens if people don't receive their absentee ballots? So there are a lot of issues, some of them concerns, and I hope that we together as a state can look at these and come to some agreement on the best and most convenient way to vote this fall.
Well, at least we're getting started on this discussion a couple months before the state primary in September, so there will be plenty of opportunities, we hope, to be able to ask those questions and get answers. Finally, Councillor Pignatelli, do you think you're going to keep trying to get the Secretary of State to appear before the Executive Council? That would require the governor to issue an invitation.
Yes, the Secretary of State told me when I talked to him that he would be happy to come to our meeting and answer questions. He's certainly willing to, but he did not want to step on any toes, and he would wait for an invitation from the governor, who sets our agenda. I don't see that happening. You know, I think he's made it quite clear that he doesn't see the Secretary of State under our purview.
Well, we'll keep an eye on things as well. Thank you, Councillor Pignatelli, for joining us on State House Watch today.
Let's listen to If You Miss Me at the Back of the Bus on Appleseed Recordings by Kim Harris and friends. And then we'll hear Arnie's interview with Louise Spencer and Kiri Claflin of the Kent Street Coalition about access to the ballot.
From
I'm joined by Louise Spencer and Kiri Claflin from the Kent Street Coalition. Welcome to State House Watch. Louise, you've been here before, but Kiri, this is your first appearance on State House Watch. So just say a little bit about how you got involved in the Kent Street Coalition.
Thanks, Arnie. I joined Kent Street Coalition right after the 2016 election. And from the beginning, my main interest has been voting rights. So I've been working with Kent Street and the New Hampshire Campaign for Voting Rights for all this time. And New Hampshire is a pretty challenging state to work on voting rights. So it's been a really interesting ride.
Voting rights is certainly something that's been in the news in the past few days. So why don't you start out, Louise, by telling us about the Superior Court decision in the case known as SB3.
This is a very exciting win that we had in Superior Court. And it comes after three long years, dating back to January of 2017, when some Republicans at the State House first started pushing for this bill in response to the claims that there was widespread voter fraud in New Hampshire, and making a big deal about buses coming up from Massachusetts and people trying to vote when they had no right to vote. Interestingly enough, in her opening remarks, the assistant AG, right off the bat in the case, said there is no widespread voter fraud. In fact, there's no significant voter fraud in New Hampshire. And that played significantly in the case. But importantly, the bottom line decision was that the judge found that the new rules of SB 3, which impacted how people register to vote, that they unduly burdened the right to vote in New Hampshire, and also that they violated the equal protection rights of certain groups of people in New Hampshire. So that was a really recognition both that of just how important it is to have accessible registration. And the judge talked about the fact that it's not just who might get turned away the day of voting at the polls, but the people that might not even show up at the polls because they are somehow intimidated by the process or somehow discouraged from showing up, worried that it might negatively impact them in some way or carry too high of a burden.
Well, of course, the accusations or allegations or charges of voter fraud are serious allegations, and it's a relatively serious crime. You can get sent to jail for committing voter fraud, so it's reasonable for people to be concerned about any type of rules that make it look like that might be what you're about to do. And we'll come back to that in a little bit when we talk about the new COVID-19 guidance issued last week. But Louise, before we get to that, it does sound like the state is going to appeal the judge's decision. So what happens next?
It's unclear what that timeline might look like. The word that I'm hearing is that it's unlikely to be considered and decided by the Supreme Court before the elections in 2020, but it's before the fall elections, but it's not entirely clear. So we just have to see. The state has said that they, after reviewing it, they do intend to appeal. So we'll have to just see how that timeline plays out. And certainly I completely agree that voter fraud is a significant problem when it occurs. What the judge found here is that there was nothing about SB 3 that was going to help to address that problem, and that people were still going to be able to vote. People had been able to vote by swearing an affidavit before, and that the bill itself really only served the function of putting obstacles in the way. So it didn't address the compelling need of preventing voter fraud.
It seems like right now the real issue with voting is that we have a pandemic and a public health order related to physical distancing. In fact, that is leading to our town halls and city clerk's offices being largely shut down. So it's kind of hard to imagine how to administer an election. And I'm curious, Kiri Claflin, how you reacted to what happened in Wisconsin recently at their primary.
I think Wisconsin is, it's really an object lesson, because that could happen elsewhere. It could happen in New Hampshire if the Secretary of the State and the governor and the legislature doesn't begin to prepare and make comprehensive plans so that it doesn't happen.
Carrie, last week, the Secretary of State and the Attorney General issued a guidance. The governor had told us to be expecting that. We heard Councillor Pignatelli make a brief reference to it. Tell us your interpretation of what is actually in that guidance, and then I'll ask you for a reaction to it.
The guidance memo essentially expands the category of who is eligible to apply for an absentee ballot. In New Hampshire, you must have an excuse. We don't have no excuse absentee ballots. So there's a form that you fill out when you request your ballot. And if you have a fear of going to the polling place during COVID-19, you can check off the box for physical disability. It's not a matter of changing any forms. It's a matter of trying to work with the forms that the state already uses.
It's interesting. The guidance says that based on their ideas that all voters have a reasonable ground to conclude that a physical disability exists within the meaning of the law due to the pandemic. Therefore, all voters may request an absentee ballot on that basis. Louise Spencer, what is the current process to request an absentee ballot?
There are a number of different areas that qualify you to get an absentee ballot. So disability is just one of them. Also being out of town for work or for other purposes, or being at home caring for a sick relative or a family member, something that makes you unable to get to the polls on the day of elections. There are a series of things that you can check. Disability, to my knowledge, has not been so broadly interpreted leading up to, you know, up until now. And so this would be a shift in how that particular view is being interpreted. You know, a fear of going to the polls because of potential illness would be a new interpretation.
How do you even get the form to request an absentee ballot?
Oh, you contact your city clerk or town clerk, and you ask them for that form, and they will either send it to you. In typical times, you could go to the city or town clerk's office to get that form. But right now, most of, if not all of the town and city offices are closed to at least in-person business. So they may be open, but they're not having the public, you know, they're not dealing directly with the public. So people are unable to pick up forms. And this presents a large problem for registration. Because in New Hampshire, registration must be done in person. So that can be done either ahead of time at the town clerk's office, or it can be done same day. In New Hampshire, we have same day registration, so it can be done at the polling places themselves. So right now we're in a situation where not only can people can request the absentee ballot by mail, but for the most part, they are unable to register to vote because that's something where they have to go in and do that in person.
I was just going to add that there is a form. I did find it. I heard it was difficult to find. There's an application form on the Secretary of State's website, which you can download if you have a computer, and you can print it out if you have a printer and send that in. So it's the same form that you would pick up, I believe, at the town hall. But it does require that you take some steps that maybe not everybody can take.
Well, it also starts out, it says, I do hereby certify under the penalties of voting fraud. So I'm concerned about that because there's been so much attention to voting fraud, and voting fraud is a criminal offense, that this, even this idea that it's okay to simply, to basically to claim to be disabled when you're not, but that there's this pandemic that makes it unsafe to go to the polling place. So I'm concerned about that. And obviously there would need to be a massive public education campaign if we're still in this physical distancing mode in September when it's time for the primary election.
And I think that Wisconsin teaches us that we need to make sure we have very solid legal underpinnings for any of the actions that we are taking. Because of course, anything would be open to a court challenge. And that would create chaos as it did in Wisconsin. So we have to be very clear that this is something that can be done under New Hampshire law. And again, it underscores the importance and urgency of getting this process rolling now and creating a plan that we know is solid and legally firm.
Carrie Claflin, the Kent Street Coalition has said that single measures such as expanded absentee voting are not enough. Clearly, as Louise has said, there's issues that have to do with registration. What else does Kent Street and the New Hampshire Campaign for Voting Rights think is necessary in order to actually have a what we might call a modern voting system in this state?
Councillor Pignatelli was really eloquent on how far the guidance memo goes and where it stops and what other categories that we should all be thinking about right now. I mean, the ultimate goal for all of us is to make elections safe, secure, and accessible. And this takes some planning, given that in New Hampshire, we are fairly restricted. Although our elections are beautifully run, we're fairly restricted. There's no registration except in person, face-to-face. There's no online registration, which most states have by now. There's no early voting. There's very limited absentee ballot voting. So I think we start from behind the eight ball if we want to get up to speed. And it's actually only a few months away. I think we'll be printing ballots in July for the September primary. We have to start, I think, working pretty soon to have a comprehensive plan.
The New Hampshire Campaign for Voting Rights has advanced just such a plan. I believe it's got 8 points. It gets pretty technical, but maybe you can mention a couple of the key elements.
Sure. The New Hampshire Campaign for Voting Rights, and Kent Street supports this wholeheartedly as a part of the Campaign for Voting Rights, we believe that there are 8 categories of things that need to be paid attention to, need to be considered. Allow any New Hampshire voter to vote by mail without excuse. To create a statewide absentee ballot application website. It's possible to cut the red tape on returning absentee ballots. Perhaps they're postage paid. Perhaps there are drop-off places, secure boxes, where they can be dropped off.
Interesting. If we get back to the issue of what we used to call a poll tax, that if people actually have to pay, and that's even buying postage, to mail your ballot in, I wonder if that could be considered an unconstitutional poll tax, especially as absentee balloting becomes more necessary.
Well, it's certainly a barrier. There are a couple of other categories, particularly registration is a concern, as Louise indicated right now. And as you said, the town offices are largely closed or certainly closed to in-person business. We need to establish election day protocols to protect voters and election officials during in-person voting. We'll always need to have in-person voting because not everyone is going to be able to do this by mail or over the internet, and some people will feel more comfortable voting in person. We will always need that, but we need to make it safe.
Well, it's certainly comical in a way that after the people concerned about voting fraud went to all this effort to require us to show picture ID when we show up at polling places, even if the poll workers are our next door neighbors or our sisters, that everybody's going to be showing up with masks on and being required to show their picture ID. So anyway, it is a little bit comical. Louise?
Yeah, I think one of the concerns I have about the Secretary of State and the governor putting out the directive on expanding absentee balloting is that people will get the impression that the problem is solved. And there's a real need to educate people that we have an election system. You know, it starts with being able to register to vote, and it moves through being able to cast your ballot, and then it's how we count those ballots. And there are pieces along the way that need to all function together in order to have safe, secure, and accessible elections. And so we cannot do this piecemeal. And so I would have preferred the governor and the Secretary of State, as much as I'm glad they took this first step, to have come out and acknowledged that we really need to be looking at this in a comprehensive way.
Carrie?
I think the guidance memo shows that Secretary Gardner and Governor Sununu recognize that there's a problem and that Granite Staters want assurances and we want some answers about how our elections are going to go forward in the fall. As you said, Wisconsin had a pretty high profile, and we should all be nervous that we don't repeat that.
Well, clearly the governor and the Secretary of State heard the outcry from groups like Kent Street and the Campaign for Voting Rights, and they have responded. And I'm glad that they responded in April and not waiting until July or August. But I'm curious, Kiri and Louise, how you expect to go forward with proposals for these other changes that are clearly necessary, especially when the legislature is not meeting. And even one question I have is, can this be done simply by more directives from the Secretary of State and the Attorney General, or do we need actual changes in the law, which requires the legislature to be in session and voting?
That's definitely part of the work that needs to be done right now. Those are all open questions. Where are the legal underpinnings for making all of this happen? Certainly, it seems that there are some possibilities for doing some of this through the emergency powers, but other things likely will require some legislative input. And so getting the legislature up and running is going to be key, at least to be able to vote on some of these essential issues that have to do with COVID-19, like the voting issues.
I do want to mention that the Federal CARES Act that was passed 2 weeks ago includes in it state election grants. So New Hampshire has been awarded an election grant of $3.2 million to get our election systems ready and up to speed to have safe, secure, accessible elections during this pandemic.
I would just like to underscore one of the important things about having the SB 3 decision come out right now is that it made clear yet again that voting is a fundamental right. So I think that we as citizens need to be clear and send a clear message to all of the players that we will not be denied our right to vote. It's something that isn't being granted to us as a favor. It's not a nice thing that just gets done in the interest of running government. It's fundamental to our democracy. And therefore, it's incumbent on all of us as citizens to make clear to our governor, to our Secretary of State, to the AG, to our legislators, to all the powers that be, that we insist that we have fair, safe, secure, and accessible elections in November, and that our right to vote not be infringed.
Well, that's great. And this will not be the last time we'll talk about voting on State House Watch. Louise Spencer and Kiri Claflin from the Kent Street Coalition, thanks for being with us today.
You are listening to WNHN LP 94.7 in Concord and WNHNFM.org. When I think about historic campaigns for voting rights, I always think about the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and Miss Fannie Lou Hamer.
Woke up this morning with my mind.
You've been listening to State House Watch Radio on WNHN 94.7 FM in Concord, streaming live at WNHNFM.org, where you'll also find podcasts of our shows every week. We broadcast on Mondays at 5 p.m. and again on Tuesday mornings at 8 a.m. You've been with Arnie Alpert and Maggie Fogarty of the American Friends Service Committee, and we will be back with you next week.
Going down the road, meeting a man. Going down the road, meeting a man. Oh, and where the climate suits my clothes. Oh, and where the climate suits my clothes. Oh, and where the climate suits my clothes. Don't want to be treated this way. Going down the road, feeling bad. Simply.